Hey, before we get to the show, I wanted to remind you to check out our Patreon at patreon.com/curbsiders. If you haven't signed up yet, sign up now to get ad-free episodes, twice-monthly bonus episodes, and a whole bunch of other cool stuff at patreon.com/curbsiders.
What's up, Paul?
Not much. Nor what's up with you?
Not much. This girl said she recognized me from the vegetarian club, but I'd never seen her before.
What? I may have missed a punchline in there. Say that one more time.
So I was going out, and this girl, she said she recognized me from the vegetarian club, but I'd never seen her before.
I genuinely don't understand.
Herbivore?
Oh, never seen her before. Okay. All right. Great. Thank you, Rahul. Can I tell my quick joke? You guys may have heard this one already. It's one of my favorite dad jokes that I was just reminded of recently.
Heck yeah.
a grasshopper walks into a bar, and the bartender looks at him. He's like, "Hey, we got a drink named after you." And the grasshopper says, "You have a drink named Larry?" Anyway.
The Curbsiders podcast is for entertainment, education, and information purposes only, and the topics discussed should not be used solely to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any diseases or conditions. Furthermore, the views and statements expressed on this podcast are solely those of the host and should not be interpreted to reflect official policy or position of any entity aside from possibly Cash Like More Hospital and affiliate outreach programs, if indeed there are any. In fact, there are none. Pretty much, we aren't responsible if you screw up. You should always do your own homework and let us know when we're wrong.
Welcome back to the Curbsiders. this is... that was a long run for a short slide. We are here tonight to do one of our Curbsiders Digest episodes, and I am joined by a large team and a special team. So on tonight's episode, we talked about several studies. And to do that, we are joined by, what was the suggestion, Dr. Garnacha? Or a live-in epidemiologist? I'm not sure.
Yeah, I like that. That's
okay, great. Our live-in epidemiologist, Dr. Rahul Garnacha. We are joined by our chief editor of the Curbsiders Digest, Dr. Nora Taranto. Dr. Taranto, how are you?
I am great. How are you, Paul?
I'm still well. And we are joined by Digest contributor, super producer, occasional co-host, but always beloved expert hospitalist and Digest associate editor, Dr. Laura Glick. Laura, how are you?
Good. How are you doing?
I'm still so good? Great. Good. still so, so good. We are joined by Dr. Adam Seafew. All right. We are also joined by special guest, Dr. Adam Seafew. Dr. Adam Seafew is a professor of medicine and a general internist at the University of Chicago, and he is one of the most sensible medicine providers we know, a lover of evidence, active on social media, has a Substack called Sensible Medicine, selected as a favorite faculty member by the graduating class of Pritzker School of Medicine almost 20 times, and he joins us to provide additional perspective and expertise on some articles that we talked about tonight. Before we get to those articles, I should remind you that this and most episodes are available for CME credit for all health professionals through VCU Health at curbsiders.org. I will also, just since we're all kinds of out of order, remind you that ordinarily we are the internal medicine podcast that use expert interviews to bring you clinical pearls and practice-changing knowledge. But tonight, the experts are we. We are the experts. So we're going to talk you through some articles about, oh gosh, prostate cancer screening and whether or not we should be doing DOACs and aspirin, and then some uncontroversial stuff like COVID vaccines and cancer, and then maybe we'll even touch on acetaminophen and neurodevelopmental disorders. So without further ado, let's get to it. All right. Well, we've been talking for a little while. We've got a large group. We have at least four articles to talk about to kind of really dive into and see if they're going to be changing our practice at all. Maybe if we're feeling sassy, we can give them some kind of rating. But Nora, why don't we start with you? You brought us an article about prostate cancer screening that has, I think, actually caught some general media buzz as well. So tell us what you read, what we were talking about, and sort of what you thought about it.
Great. So I'm going to be bringing us today a discussion of the European study of prostate cancer screening. This is the ERSPC. And this study has actually now published its 23-year follow-up, which is quite a bit of follow-up for a screening study and just a study generally. It's published several prior updates to follow-up since the study was initiated in 1993. And just as a little bit of background relating to the significance of this study, the study focused on prostate cancer screening, which obviously if caught early before it's spread outside the prostate remains curable. And so that's with surgery or radiation, with or without other medications. Now, it's also a disease of aging. And so there are many men who develop prostate cancer who may have other conditions. And so the question has arisen over the last several decades about whether or not we're screening the right patients for prostate cancer, whether or not we're leading by screening too many patients to overdiagnosis of prostate cancers that aren't ever going to actually cause patients problems or lead to prostate cancer mortality or mortality broadly speaking. And so there have been a number of studies over the last several decades that have looked at prostate cancer screening with a PSA or a prostate specific antigen. This is a blood test that can be drawn either once or multiple times over years. And what the effect of prostate cancer screening with this blood test, the PSA, is on prostate cancer mortality. There were two other studies that are relevant besides the ERSPC, and one of them was run in the UK over several decades. One of them was run in the US, and then this one was run in 8 countries in Europe. This study, I believe, had the longest follow-up of any of them and has the most recent and kind of modern follow-up, for lack of a better description. And in the ERSPC, this study randomized patients in those 8 European countries to either an invitation to PSA screening between the ages of 55 and 69, or a control arm with no invitation to screening. Individuals in the screening arm were offered repeated testing that ranged, I think, between 2 and 8 tests over 15 years, with intervals anywhere between 2 and 4 years and ending around age 70, 71 to 74. Positive PSA testing, so that's using typically a threshold of around 3, reflex to further diagnostic testing and standard care from there. The primary outcome of the study was prostate cancer specific mortality, and then they did have secondary outcomes looking at the incidence of prostate cancer stratified by risk category of prostate cancer at the time of diagnosis. And so this overall was a positive study. They did find at this median follow-up of 23 years that prostate cancer mortality was 13% lower in the screening group than in the control group. And that correlated with an absolute risk reduction of 0.22%. Now, I guess from there, I'm curious what you all thought about this study and kind of PSA screening broadly speaking and how this fits into like what your recommendations are for patients. Obviously, there have been a number of guidelines that have conflicting recommendations and have changed their recommendations. Paul, first off, what was your thought about the acronym?
It's fine. I'm not sure I love catchy acronyms for life-threatening diseases in general, but I don't know. It's certainly not memorable, but also not the point. So thank you for that excellent question. Yeah, I guess, I don't know. I've been doing this long enough that I've seen prostate cancer screening, the thinking around that kind of flip back and forth a couple of times, but I can't think of many screenings that have as much consistent hate as prostate cancer screening has. Like even when the guidelines sort of flip more towards the shared decision-making model, I think no one was really excited about that. I don't know that a lot of residents or trainees even know that that's the current model that's recommended. And even when the study came out, I heard a little bit of buzz about how, well, this is going to be spun the wrong way. And actually PSA screening is still awful. So I think I'm glad the study was done. And I think it's great to have the conversation, but yeah, it's in terms of a screening, something that we screen for, like this is one that is just, it's been hated for almost as long as I can remember. And I'm not entirely, I mean, I know why, but also I'm not entirely sure why. So those, even before getting into the nitty-gritty of the details, that was sort of the context that I was bringing you to this.
I'll chime in and say, I sort of celebrated this because I think it's the last time we'll have to deal with a prostate cancer screening trial, right? Like this is the last study that the sort of placebo group, right, the unscreened group will actually be more or less unscreened, right? That kind of doomed the PLCO study, the American study, because so much of the non-screened group got PSA testing. And this, you know, we're 23 years out, you could never redo this study. So at least, like, we'll never have to talk about this again. And when you're talking about prostate cancer, which is a disease of older people, right, 23-year follow-up is enough. And then I can hate on it whenever we're ready for that.
This reminds me of a prior study we've discussed on this show, and that was the Nordic trial of colonoscopy screening. And, you know, lots of parts of this kind of harken back to the discussion we had about that. In particular, something a little wonky, the use of what is called Zellan randomization, which is where informed consent happens after randomization. And that's something that's sort of typical of population-based or registry studies. But you could imagine that the act of consent itself might influence someone's behavior with regard to screening for a cancer. And so, you know, in this trial, it was a relatively large proportion of patients who underwent the screening, which was not the case in the Nordic trial. So there's, you know, some important differences there. But I'm wondering, for those of you who, you know, talk to patients about prostate cancer screening, I mean, is learning all of the details about the cancer and about the pros and cons of screening, I think that's sort of the intent that, you know, we're supposed to be having with those discussions with patients now. But I could imagine that that is really something that would affect your behavior around vigilance and screening.
I think it's a little bit of an issue of the design of the study as well as the results of the study, right? Because the fact that we're comparing, you know, intention to screen with not is very much producing population data, right? Rather than the kind of what would be considered per protocol in this, which is the patient level data as like, yes, you were screened or you were not screened. And it's kind of irritating as like a primary care doctor, where when you have that discussion, you know, my experience over the years has been just about every man says yes. And the men who don't say yes, after I've like, you know, brought them through this incredibly well-planned, well-articulated kind of consent, they're like, well, what would you do? And I'm like, ah, God, you're right. It's silly for me to do that because I think about this all the time and you've thought about it for the 90 seconds I've been talking to you.
And I think it's also interesting to just mention that it's worthwhile thinking about how to use this data, given, I think we mentioned this before, but how much change has happened in the screening and evaluation of prostate cancer in general. So this, you know, likely reflects more of the older diagnostic biopsy and treatment pathways. And I think now we use MRIs a lot more often in active surveillance to guide the biopsy decision. So it's, I would love to hear your thoughts on how to use this data, given that we have this newer diagnostic imaging and management approach, which ideally balances like the risks versus the benefits of screening, may be different now with how we use it.
Yeah, and that's kind of one of the limitations that I think the authors raise, and I think that the author of the editorial that kind of accompanied it raised as well, just that we do often with these like long-term screening studies have this issue of like changes in standard of care over the time of screening, and changes to all of your points about kind of how recommendations have changed over time for PSA screening, like what the control arm, what the no invitation to screening arm was actually receiving over time. And so that makes it hard to parse out what the effect of like the screening test itself is here. But it is true, totally, Laura, like we are not necessarily in prostate cancer management intervening on and kind of from a surgical perspective, actually removing every low-risk prostate cancer. There are patients who actually do go on to active surveillance for years where they're getting repeat imaging, they're getting repeat testing before they actually undergo the surgery if they have other things that are higher risk and that warrant more focus, or if they just have a really low risk cancer to begin with. And so I do think some of that worry about overtreatment and the harms of overtreatment have been mitigated by the kind of improvements in testing and management.
Wait, I got to jump in and call you on that, because we do this all the time whenever we have a unimpressive screening study that everybody says, ah, well, come on, we do it so much better now, right? And like, is that ever actually borne out? Like, I'll just get into the data here, right? I mean, this is, you gave the, whatever it was, 0.22% decrease in prostate cancer specific death, right? That's tiny, right? They give us a number needed to screen of 456, right? That means that if I screen basically all the men in my clinic, you know, I save about one life over 23 years. That's nothing. The cost of that is that I diagnose 30% more men with prostate cancer than I would have otherwise. And then the number that like struck me so much in this study is that we save one life from prostate cancer, save one person from prostate cancer death for every 12 men diagnosed, right? So that means that 11 out of 12 men diagnosed with cancer, I harm rather than help. Because even if we do a terrific job with, oh, selecting the right person, you know, you've still given that that person a diagnosis of cancer.
Yeah, I mean, whether outcomes other than, you know, prostate cancer specific mortality are important, I think is the point that you're bringing up, Adam. And like, I mean, the answer is definitely. And one outcome that I see as kind of missing from this study is, you know, some quantification of, you know, what is the harm that men experience who are diagnosed with either early stage or low risk prostate cancer. I mean, you know, we know that the surgeries are, you know, morbid and come with complications. So I think like a more nuanced understanding for me of, you know, what exactly are the costs of, you know, the one life per 450 some people screened saved. In my view, that was, it's one piece that's kind of missing from this study.
This is my other question is mortality the right or the most important outcome for this particular cancer? I think is the other way that you're asking that question. And maybe this is salience bias, but like the most impactful cases of prostate cancer I've seen have been, you know, bony metastases. And like, you know, it's, is there other stuff that we could make better by doing a better job of screening that is not necessarily mortality? Because again, this is happening in older patients where probably something may otherwise may get them anyway. So, you know, because I agree, because like the prostate cancer mortality in and of itself is probably not super duper impressive, but I think there are potential downstream benefits of actually catching sort of early prostate cancer in the right patient, but how to define that is a challenge.
Yeah, I was going to say, I think there's some, one of my open questions here is it feels like each of these studies has done the screening in different ways, slightly different ways or very different ways. And then also kind of the exact population and the age thresholds for the population are different. And I don't know within the age range, whether the age range is the correct one that was chosen in the study to start and end between 55 and 69 as kind of the prostate cancers that are the most aggressive and that we would theoretically want to catch the earliest are the ones that happen in younger men. And so that's kind of one, I think, serious limitation to a number of these studies that I had trouble parsing out in the data here, like where that population is within this bigger population, which it's obviously really hard to find those individuals. But I think those are the folks that I suspect would benefit the most from a screening approach at all.
My struggle with this is that, you know, and I think what I've already sort of hinted at, right, I think all this data is so underwhelming as to make me think, you know, the weight of this is that we've just done harm to now two, maybe three generations of men through prostate cancer screening. All that said, right, there are men in their 50s who I've sent PSAs on who've ended up having Gleason 7 prostate cancer, who I'm pretty sure I've saved their life, right? And so although I can kind of sit here as, you know, like an EBM guy and be like, oh my God, this is terrible. You know, we're diagnosing 11 out of 12 people with prostate cancer that wouldn't have hurt them to save one life. I also, when I'm actually sitting with a younger man, I do feel like maybe that cost is worthwhile. but it like behooves us to how we really should be doing significant counseling on with men, which I think the vast majority of people don't. This is just part of the Chem 30 that you get when you go to the doctor, and most women get screened for prostate cancer too because of that.
Yeah, I was going to ask what your practices are with the discussion at this point. It sounds like varying.
Yeah, I do try to do counseling in certain forms and have the conversation around it with the appropriate patients. I just want to mention, and then we should wrap up and move on. I want to hear your hotcakes rating, whether this is going to change. Are we doing hotcakes ratings this, or you'll let us know if this at least changes your practice. But the decision to biopsy at a threshold of 3 nanograms per milliliter, I just have to sort of comment on, is not like that these days would be an insane thing to sort of practically do too. So I like it, just to Laura's point, there has been an evolution sort of, now they're talking like reference ranges that are actually sort of age specific. So I wonder how that impacts things to some extent, but that's maybe a conversation for a different time. So
can we also just mention that they just threw out the whole country of France because they didn't comply with the protocol? That was, I was amused by that.
It's worth mentioning.
That's more typical of the US though. Like apparently only like 30 to 40% of men in the US who are eligible undergo PSA screening.
Interesting.
I mean, in this study, like it, and you know, they called it an intention to screen study, but I kind of wonder how fair that is, because you know, if over 80% of the people are doing the screening, that's definitely not what we're doing here. So just, it makes me think that these mortality estimates might be more of an upper bound rather than kind of a lower bound.
It's really more typical of Britain, though, to ignore everything from France.
Very un-French.
All right, Nora, is this going to change your practice? What is your summary? Take us home.
I don't think it's going to change my practice. I still have a number of questions about, to Adam's point, the right population in which to have this discussion. It's not going to lead me not to have that discussion.
I have to parse that out.
Yeah. But I do think it's still really hard to know how frequently to offer this, to whom to offer this. And I completely agree that the number needed to screen is really not particularly impressive. And so I think it's a conversation as opposed to a kind of mandate from my book.
Yeah, practically, I don't see this actually changing any guidelines. I think they'll still just say talk to the patient and sort of leave it in the individual PCP's hands.
This episode is brought to you by Freed. Do you feel like you can never get ahead of charting? Imagine a world where you don't need to think about notes again. Introducing Freed, an AI medical scribe built to free clinicians everywhere. It listens, transcribes, and writes instant clinical notes for you in your style. Freed can be used across all specialties for in-office as well as virtual visits, and it works in multiple languages. Written in your style and ready the moment the visit is over, all you have to do is copy it in your EHR. Freed is HIPAA compliant and only takes seconds to learn. Over 1,500 clinicians, including doctors, APPs, therapists, use Freed to save up to 200 hours every day and free themselves from documentation. Just imagine the great feeling of coming home without any notes hanging over your head, get back to doing what you love, and let Freed do the rest. Listen, I've been using Freed for 2 years, and I have to say, having a medical scribe is game-changing. It saves you so much time. You're not going to be at home writing notes in your pajamas. Get your life back and try Freed. Start your free trial today. No credit card needed. Use the code CURB50 to get $50 off your first month when you subscribe. Visit getfreed.ai and use the code CURB50 to get $50 off your first month. Hey, Curbsiders, if you're planning your CME for the end of the year and beyond, check out our friends at Continuing Education Company. They offer ACCME accredited and ABIM mock approved CME with a strong focus on primary care and hospital medicine. CEC hosts 20 live conferences each year in top destinations, including Florida Keys and the Big Island of Hawaii this fall, and Naples, Florida, and Maui this winter. All conferences feature half-day sessions, so your afternoons are free to relax or explore. And for hospitalists, don't miss the 9th annual Hospitalist Conference in Clearwater Beach, Florida's number one beach, coming up December 1st to 4th. Speakers include Curbsider's own, the legendary Dr. Rahul Ganatra, plus another Curbsider's legend, Dr. Tony Brew, with his popular talk, Things We Do For No Reason. Can't make it in person? All events are available via live stream with on-demand replays if you need flexibility. Plus, explore CEC's vast library of online CME with over 500 hours of on-demand courses across primary care and hospital medicine. Use the promo code CURB30 to get 30% off all online courses and webcasts just for Curbsiders listeners. Visit cmemeeting.org/curbsiders to learn more. That's cmemeeting.org/curbsiders and use the promo code CURB30.
All right. Great, great start. We are moving on to an article that generated quite a bit of lay buzz. There's been a lot of conversation about acetaminophen and autism, Rahul. So you wrote us an article. Yeah, no, I love that you chose this one. Tell us all about it and sort of how we should start to think about it.
Sure. Okay, friends. So for my selection for today, we're discussing a systematic review without a meta-analysis by Prada and colleagues. And I'll just note that the senior author is the dean for the School of Public Health at Harvard University. This is a systematic review that appears in a recent issue of Environmental Health. And the research question that this study was asking is whether maternal use of acetaminophen during pregnancy is associated with the subsequent development, or I should say the subsequent diagnosis of autism, attention deficit hyperactivity disorder, or ADHD, or other neurodevelopmental disorders in children. So why is this study important? Well, this study is important because it sort of formed the basis for the FDA's recommendation in September of 2025 to change the label for acetaminophen to reflect caution around these risks. And the FDA also sent a letter to physicians, which we can link in the show notes. It's pretty short, about the risks of acetaminophen use during pregnancy. And kind of independent of those actions, though, it's my thought that clinicians with any stake in promoting maternal and child health are going to face questions about, you know, how seriously should people take these findings and, you know, how safe or harmful is acetaminophen in pregnancy. So before we get into the details, first of all, I'll just apologize to all of you for asking you to read this like 45-page PDF with all the tables and supplements. This was kind of a doozy.
Can I just, I'm going to be the one to say it. The table's unforgivable. Like there's 20 pages of like small tables, each one occupying a single page, long, oriented the wrong direction.
Oriented the wrong direction. I can't handle it.
It killed me.
Yeah. I mean, I knew that my contribution to this discussion would be simply having read the entire PDF. So you're welcome, everybody. So, and you know, we're kind of joking about this, but it really does get to why this is such a nuanced issue and such a difficult issue to really have a belief supported by evidence on, because it's really difficult to kind of wade through all the information that's contained. But anyway, what are the top line findings for us to start with? I'll just read you the conclusion from the abstract, because I think that that really kind of encapsulates a lot of, you know, what people are reacting to about this paper. So the conclusion of the abstract reads, our analysis supports evidence consistent with an association between acetaminophen exposure during pregnancy and increased incidence of NDDs, neurodevelopmental disorders. They go on to say appropriate and immediate steps should be taken to advise pregnant women to limit acetaminophen consumption to protect their offspring's neurodevelopment. So before I get into the details of this, I'm just curious, you know, initial reactions to the language used in the conclusion of the abstract or to anything about the sort of setup of this that people have so far?
I mean, it makes me want to just jump up and down and scream, right? I mean, this is like the greatest editorial failure ever. You know, that first sentence, right, about, you know, there's evidence consistent with an association is true based on their data, and we can talk about how important that is. But then to make the jump from an association to, you know, causation and action is appalling and tells you that there was a whole lot else going on here other than science.
I totally agree. I mean, I think that's a really crucial pickup about this. We haven't talked about the data at all yet. And already, you know, differentiating the use of causal language from language describing an association is a really critical part of the messaging about data like this. I'm curious what the rest of you think.
Yeah, I had a similarly strong strong and critical reaction, mostly to that point of like making policy recommendations about management of patients based on an associational study or a set of associational studies primarily, and making recommendations that just seemed like entirely unhelpful, like that patients who are pregnant with a fever, instead of taking Tylenol, should cool themselves and seek medical consultation, which just like, yes. I just couldn't grapple with that being the recommendation here that came out of this study.
Yeah. Yeah. So I agree. So a lot of, you know, people's initial reactions to the, you know, not only the use of causal language where it's maybe not warranted, and also kind of, you know, lack of consideration of what are the alternatives. I think those are very fair reactions. So I'm only going to tell you a little bit about how the study was done, because this is a systematic review. It's huge. You know, we can't go into all the details without putting everyone to sleep. So I'm just going to tell you a few things about the highlights, and then we can discuss a little more. So basically, this was a systematic review that included 46 observational studies. 20 of those studies assessed the association between acetaminophen use and ADHD. 8 assessed the association with autism, and then another 18 assessed the association with other neurodevelopmental disorders. Okay. And the authors, because they didn't undertake a meta-analysis, really all they can say by way of summarizing the results is how many studies showed a positive association, a null association, or no association, or a negative association, meaning a protective effect of acetaminophen. And those numbers are 27 showed, you know, some indication of association, 9 were null, and 4 indicated a protective effect. So to give you a sense of what the included studies were, I'm just going to tell you a little bit about one study that I think really exemplifies some of the problems with this systematic review, and then we can talk a little bit about, you know, some of the limitations therein. So one representative study that's included is a study that was in a 2024 issue of JAMA by Alkvist and colleagues. And this was a population-based retrospective cohort study of 2.5 million Swedish children who were born between 1995 and 2019. And these authors did something pretty cool. They did two analyses, one of which was a crude analysis, just looking at rates of autism diagnosed by age 10 between children exposed to acetaminophen in utero compared with children not exposed in utero. Okay, pretty standard stuff. They also did something called a sibling-controlled analysis. And this is a sub-study in which pairs of siblings with the same biological parents who were exposed to acetaminophen and were not exposed to acetaminophen were compared to each other. And that analysis is meant to control for unmeasured genetic and environmental confounders. And this type of study is really valuable when you're looking at exposures to things in utero where we maybe don't know all of the exact confounders that could affect that. And that study, the crude analysis found a very small increase in risk for autism. The hazard ratio was 1.05, okay? And the absolute percentages were low, 1.33 versus 1.53, okay? And that association was completely attenuated in the sibling analysis. The hazard ratio was not significant. The absolute differences were not significant. So I'm curious now, you know, before we talk a little bit about some of the specific problems with this study, I mean, does this affect how you think about studying the association between acetaminophen and autism? Can people anticipate any problems in studying that association?
These are incredibly difficult associations to pick up, right? Because these are generally, you know, the impact of a maternal exposure and the relationship of that to a disease tends to be very small. And so when we've been successful with this in the past has been things like thalidomide or DES exposure, where we've been able to do case control studies or even case series to show a really clear effect. You know, we get the sense from this that if there is an effect, which I have to say, I don't think there is, the effect is minuscule. And so it is, unfortunately, I think, probably going to be impossible to detect. I love the study that you picked out here. And I also love it that you really made it clear that, right, this is not a meta-analysis. And although we were all tortured with these multiple tables, right, there were none of the forest plots that we always sort of look for and say, like, what's the effect size and how does this all come to be? But even in this Swedish study, the Ahlquist, not the sibling study, right, 2.4 million people, and they come up with a hazard ratio of 1.04. And, you know, I've always taught that in an observational study, in a cohort study, with all the noise there is, you know, if the relationship is less than two, right, a hazard ratio of less than two, an odds ratio of less than two, you should basically ignore it. And here, you know, we're getting news for an odds hazard ratio of 1.05. You just kind of got a shrug.
I also was, I don't know whether any of you guys got a better sense of the, I was lacking a like mechanistic explanation to this that I really struggled with. Like, and the fact that it seemed like some of these studies found more effect kind of later in the pregnancy when you don't think as much about neurodevelopment happening, though obviously that's like simplifying it entirely, but I just really struggled with the lack of like why this could be the case, and they really didn't provide that to me, at least that I could find in the discussion, and so that made me question all of these results even more, especially when they started talking about the kind of two hit hypothesis where like Tylenol was actually the first hit and the second hit was the fever, instead of thinking about, oh, why were they taking Tylenol? Probably because of the fever.
I think, Nora, you brought up a good point about the heterogeneity of the different studies. So just in terms of, you know, how the defining the exposure, some, you know, some were using some included any use of Tylenol, some were duration, some was the timing, like the trimester, and you know, some use biomarkers, but I think with all that heterogeneity of it's very hard to synthesize any results.
Cards on the table. I tried very hard to kind of separate my own personal feelings about the politics surrounding this discussion with the actual outcomes, and really tried to almost be devil's advocate and try to be on the side of like, how can I believe that this is actually true? Mm-hmm. Because I know my inclination would be to think like, this is nonsense because of the source, if I'm being perfectly honest. Not the authors themselves, but again, sort of the political environment from which this is sort of has stemmed. So that I struggled with, but even so, like even the discussion seems sort of very, I'm just being reasonable here. There's a lot of details and sort of that I'm not sure that didn't fully line up. And I still didn't feel satisfied that there was a great explanation at the end of the day. Even the cited animal study that talked about the neurotoxicity of acetaminophen and leading to neurodevelopmental delays, that was not my read on the paper when I actually went to the citation itself. Like it, so it's, I came away from this overall with to Adam's point, with a big shrug. Like I just, there's a lot of words and a lot of stuff that was talked about, but nothing that felt especially compelling to me, which is not a very scientific way, but that it's just, that is what I kind of walked away from this gigantic paper with.
Yeah. I mean, I'm hearing lots of very important limitations. You know, the strength of the association being small is a big problem for an observational study where confounding is virtually guaranteed. The presence of unmeasured confounding, we are very worried is happening as a result of what we saw in the Ahlquist study. There's a couple other problems that I'll share with you before I give you my final take home on this. You know, autism is sort of a heterogeneous spectrum and a constellation of things. So the absence of a single unifying mechanistic, you know, pathophysiology here, I mean, that's, you're not imagining that. It's, we're studying something that is a very heterogeneous label applied to many different things. So that's going to be a challenge. And then there's another problem that we haven't really discussed yet. And this is really getting into the weeds. And so I will leave listeners to kind of, you know, view the directed acyclic graph that we'll put in the show notes. But there's a big problem here, which is confounding by indication. And with this basically gets at is, how do we know that acetaminophen is the putative cause leading to the outcome and not the indication that acetaminophen is taken for? And I've tried to diagram this out a little bit. We can, you know, direct listeners to that. But I mean, this is particularly evident for febrile infections during pregnancy. I mean, we know that that is, especially when fever is untreated, is thought to increase risk for neurodevelopmental disorders, including autism. And disaggregating whether the increased risk comes from the acetaminophen or the reason the acetaminophen is being taken is a really subtle and not straightforward issue. So there's a bunch of reasons to doubt the conclusions as presented in the abstract.
Thank you. I'm glad that you mentioned the confounding by indication specifically. So what, Rahul, do we do with this? So does this change your management? How are we, like, I guess, where, what are you taking away from this after being the person who did the deep dive? So what is your take home point? How do you, what should we do with this information such as is?
Yeah. I mean, what I take away from this is that there unfortunately is really a dearth of high quality evidence to inform, you know, what pregnant women should do when it comes to weighing the risks and benefits of acetaminophen during pregnancy. I mean, I will say that there are clear harms to alternatives to acetaminophen, like NSAIDs and aspirin, that acetaminophen doesn't have. And there are harms to maternal fever, especially if it's prolonged and untreated during pregnancy. And the label already says to consult with a healthcare professional before use, and that's a position that's supported by professional societies like ACOG. So to me, this is not practice changing. And if anything, this is more of a cautionary tale about the harms of the careless application of causal language to low quality evidence for political gain.
All right. Beautifully said.
This episode is brought to you by DoxGPT by Doximity. You've probably heard about DoxGPT. It's Doximity's new HIPAA-compliant AI tool that helps you get quick, evidence-based answers right when you need them at the point of care. And if you already trust Doximity for Dialer, you know they build tools that actually make your day easier. I'm a big fan of AI tools, and I've been using DocsGPT for several months now. And what I like about it is, whether I'm looking for the latest guidelines or asking drug information, the answers come back instantly, clearly referenced, and clinically sound. Think of DocsGPT as a ChatGPT for medicine built specifically for clinicians. It gives you concise, reference-backed answers to clinical questions and drug lookups in seconds. The drug info is not AI-made. It's pulled directly from peer-reviewed literature and FDA data. And it's not just for clinical questions. DocsGPT can help with documentation, insurance letters, and patient education, saving you time on that admin work that eats into your day and your night. DocsGPT is private by default, fully HIPAA compliant, and secure, so you can use it confidently in your clinical workflow. Every U.S. clinician gets 100% free access to DocsGPT, and through Doximity, you'll also get complimentary access to virtually every medical journal, so you can go from question to question, citation to source, seamlessly, and all in one place. It's fast, intuitive, and built right into the Doximity platform. No setup, no subscriptions, no hidden paywalls, just instant answers that fit right into your workflow. If you haven't tried it yet, check out DocsGPT by Doximity and see how it can simplify your clinical workflow from patient care to paperwork. Visit DocsGPT.com or use the link in the show notes to start using it today. That's DocsGPT.com or use the link in the show notes. This episode is brought to you by Aura Frames. Look, if you are a last-minute Christmas shopper, if you're that procrastinator around the holidays, always waiting till the last minute to get a gift, then don't wait till the last minute this year. Order now. Aura Frame is a fantastic and thoughtful gift, and by definition, it's personalized because you can load it with all your favorite photos when you give it to that special someone in your life. Maybe it's your mom, maybe it's your dad, maybe it's your partner. I don't know, whoever's special, this is a great gift. What I love about Aura Frame is that you can preload it with a bunch of photos before it ships and keep adding them anytime, anywhere. And you can add a personalized message to your gift, and you can keep sharing photos effortlessly straight from your phone all year long. For a limited time, save on the perfect gift by visiting AuraFrames.com to get $35 off Aura's best-selling Carver Matte Frames, named number one by Wirecutter, and use the promo code curb at checkout. That's auraframes.com, promo code curb. This deal is exclusive to listeners and frames sell out fast. So order yours now to get it in time for the holidays. Support the show by mentioning us at checkout. Terms and conditions apply.
Well, let's move on to our next article. So we're going to move away from controversy and just talk about COVID and cancer risk, which I seems like much safer territory. But before we do that, I would actually, Adam, if you would indulge us, can I ask you to speak on the blue after visit summary framing of this? Because I love it so much. And I just want to make sure that our listeners actually have a chance to hear about this before we talk about this paper.
Maybe I'll save that since that gets so much to my interpretation of the article. But I was so proud of that. I'm glad you mentioned it. I can talk a little bit about the study, and I'll try to be fast because I don't think it deserves actually a whole lot of attention. So this study was published in Biomarker Research. It's called 1 Year Risks of Cancer Associated with COVID-19 Vaccination, a large population-based cohort study in South Korea. And it was written by Kim and colleagues. So it actually, on first brush, sort of seems like a pretty impressive study. It's a cohort study that compared about 2.4 million patients who received the COVID vaccine between 2021 and 2023. And it compared them with about 595,000 patients, or people really, who did not get the COVID vaccine. The data was obtained from the Korean National Health Insurance Database, which, as far as I can tell, is a pretty reliable database for getting that information, who did and did not get the shot. The authors then, you know, categorized these people into vaccinated and not vaccinated. And the authors then just examined the incidence of 30 different cancers in these two groups. And what they found in the sort of highlight is that 6 cancer types, breast, gastric, prostate, colon, thyroid, and lung, were more common in the vaccinated people. And the hazard ratios, they made the hazard ratios for acetaminophen and autism look like nothing. The hazard ratios went from 1.2 for breast cancer all the way up to 1.7 for prostate cancer. And I think not surprisingly, because it's about the COVID vaccine, this got a lot of play, both in the regular media and certainly on social media among the sort of, I don't know, vaccine skeptical, vaccine hesitant crowd. And so I wanted to cover it to amplify it even more. I wanted to cover it because I thought that there were such clear and obvious errors in the data that I just thought was worth putting that out there, because I think they packed a lot of mistakes into a 4-page paper. So maybe I'll open it up to people. Thoughts reading this?
Yeah, I mean, I really like the exercise of reading a paper where, you know, you don't agree with the conclusions, just to sort of diagram your thinking and your thought process. I mean, you're preaching to the choir with that. And, you know, Paul, something you said thinking about the acetaminophen paper really got me thinking, you know, just to play devil's advocate, like how could you, you know, what would you need to accept these results as true? In my mind, Adam, that is exactly like how I approach a paper like this, is thinking like, okay, what would need to be true? What would I need to believe about the analysis in order to accept these results? So I'm looking forward to hearing how you walk through a paper like this.
So as I read this, I think the first thing I always think about is bioplausibility, right? How likely is this to be an issue? I am certainly not a molecular biologist, but from everything I know about vaccinations, even the, you know, quote unquote dreaded mRNA vaccination, is it's hard to believe there is going to be impact on human DNA from vaccination, which I'd expect is what would happen if we were seeing cancer. I'd also expect there to be a long lag time between vaccination and cancer. And so certainly, even if this is true, I don't think we would see this until analysis sort of 20 years hence. And so those two things were the first things that really raised alarm bells in me is that when you look at this data, the curves between the vaccinated group and the non-vaccinated groups separate essentially immediately. And even, you know, with studies of survivors of the Hiroshima and Nagasaki bombs, we didn't see that sort of injury. And so that's kind of shocking. And interestingly, all of that ill effect seems to happen in the first 6 months. The curves separate over 6 months and then become parallel after 6 months. So it seems like the putative harm, I guess I would call it, happens immediately and then sort of disappears. And then the next step for me is, well, what could be the difference? Like, why are we seeing this? And this took a little bit of research for me, because certainly primary care in South Korea is a little bit different than primary care in the United States. And it turns out that the six cancers that did increase are things that are, if not routinely screened for, commonly screened for in South Korea. So for us, certainly breast, lung, colon, and prostate are things that are screened at doctor's visits or soon after, once you can get your patient in for a colonoscopy. That's actually true as well with gastric cancer and thyroid cancer in Korea. So I think it becomes very clear that what we're doing is we're comparing people who went to the doctor, got screened for cancer, and often also got a COVID shot with people who didn't see a doctor, didn't get screened for cancer, and also didn't get a COVID shot.
I feel like for me, looking at this, one of the things that kind of immediately raised red flags that I'm curious whether this is kind of how you guys interpret it as well is just seeing the effect primarily like all in the same direction across everything they looked at and seeing it in kind of everything they looked at pretty much, even if it wasn't a significant association. And so that was kind of one interesting reflection I had. I was like, oh yeah, this does raise some flags, and perhaps this is a good tool with which to kind of look at results when people are doing multiple analyses in this kind of exploratory way.
Yeah, I mean, it does kind of beg the question, you know, what apart from receipt of the COVID vaccine could explain a difference, and a difference that becomes apparent, you know, quickly in rates of cancer diagnosis between these two groups. And, you know, I mean, Adam, you having looked into this paper the most are kind of in the best position to speak on that. And me as a non-subject matter expert, all I bring to this are questions about, you know, does this make sense or not? But I'm trying to think, you know, biologically, from a mechanistic standpoint, you know, what could explain oncogenesis on the time frame of months? I mean, Nora, I don't think you need to go to oncology fellowship to sort of know that that's really fast.
It's
for
fast.
You know, solid for solid cancers. So, I mean, it, you know, it does raise the question, is this about, you know, oncogenesis, or is this about detection of cancers? And something about the people who got vaccinated that is reflective of their underlying propensity to seek care as being different from people who did not get vaccinated. Unfortunately, there weren't really any indicators of that in the paper. I mean, there are things that could be measured to try to get at that, like the number of visits a person had in the year preceding their diagnosis, how up to date a person was with recommended cancer screenings. Like, there's ways this could have been assessed. And I kind of expect that had those been included as covariates in the propensity score, that this association across all the cancer types might have been attenuated.
Well, I think that's a great point. And it's, you know, I came away from this study a little bit amused and just a little bit of depressed at the state of the medical literature, right? Because we know that journal editors pay attention to, you know, clicks and citations. It's kind of their job. And I had to come away from this thinking that a short paper like this, whose the problems of which are so obvious, and that there's not even a nod to, you know, what you mentioned, other things that could be controlled for, to try to control for confounders, wasn't done. You know, you feel like this was almost knowingly seeking attention rather than trying to improve our understanding of biomedicine, you know, 5 years after the beginning of the pandemic.
Yeah, I think in my opinion, if there's one thing that I learned from Adam Cipu's class, my first year of medical school, it was to digest these articles and or dissect the articles and try and figure out potential sources of bias, and I think this one has plenty, so I see why you chose it. I think one that really stood out to me, which we kind of mentioned, is this healthy user bias, which is the type of selection bias. When people engage in a particular behavior are just inherently either healthy or at least have different characteristics compared to those who do not, independent of that exposure being studied. And I think what we've gotten to, and you know, I think Rahul's point is, you know, we don't have great understanding of the whole picture, but people who are more likely to take the preventative measures like the vaccine are likely also more likely to be seeing a doctor and then undergoing those cancer screenings. And as such, they're more likely to have those cancers detected.
Boy, that warms my heart just to hear my course. A hat tip to the course and you talking about that so perfectly.
Well, and while we're buttering your bread, I will just encourage our listeners to head to your Substack and read the Blue After Visit summaries, which kind of frames this type of conversation in a way that I found really helpful to think about. So, Adam, in terms of what to do with this information, I guess, you know, the big question for you is should we screen patients who've received the COVID vaccine for cancer? Is that, or I guess more broadly, what should we do with this information, if anything, other than just be cautious with what we read?
I think if they are in your office and you're considering giving them the COVID vaccine, it should not affect your decision to screen them. You should screen them as you would otherwise. And I would use this paper maybe as a teaching tool in the future and otherwise ignore it.
All right, excellent. Let's move on to our last article. Laura, you brought us an article about patients with chronic coronary syndrome. And today I learned that we're calling it chronic coronary syndrome and not,
yes, we are.
Not something else. And what to do with their, potentially with their aspirin and oral anticoagulants if they're on them. So tell us a little bit about what you brought to us and what we should do with it.
Yeah. So to end this episode, let's talk a little bit about some of the new evidence regarding the use of long-term aspirin on top of oral anticoagulation in patients with high atherothrombotic risk. So this is the Aquatic trial. It's a multi-center, double-blinded, randomized controlled trial. It was done in France and published in New England Journal of Medicine, and it was comparing aspirin versus placebo in addition to oral anticoagulation in patients with chronic coronary syndrome who had previously undergone PCI over 6 months prior to enrollment and were at a high atherothrombotic risk and also requiring long-term oral anticoagulation. So the study included a total of 872 patients, and they were randomly assigned to receive either aspirin 100 milligrams daily or placebo in addition to their oral anticoagulation with the primary outcome of major adverse cardiovascular event. So the trial was actually stopped early after a median of about 2 years due to harm in the dual therapy group, with about a 50% relative increase in major adverse cardiovascular events, mostly driven by cardiovascular death, and also a tripling in bleeding risk in that group.
I mean, I'm confused. I understand the increase in bleeding risk. I feel like that has been demonstrated in other related literature, but maybe some of you smart people can help me understand, like, why would there be an increase in cardiovascular death? Like, is there some mechanism outside of bleeding that biologically could explain that? That was one thing that sort of struck me, you know, upfront about the results of this paper. I expected the harm to be, you know, increased risk of bleeding, which there was, but I was unprepared and still am kind of struggling to explain this increase in cardiovascular mortality.
You know, honestly, I also struggled with that. And I think it's interesting to note, too, that the risk of the events in this aquatic trial were actually like 7 to 8 times higher than in previous trials in the field related. You know, the group studied in those trials were slightly different. But in general, you know, that's a pretty big increase in the number of events. And I'm not sure I have a great explanation for that either.
Yeah, I was kind of in my mind like, oh, maybe I it would have been interesting to understand a little more the patients who had those events and whether or not they had concomitant bleeding events. Mm-hmm. That was what I think, Rahul, you had also been kind of thinking along those potential lines that sometimes, you know, hypoperfusion, bleeding, causing a cardiac event, something like that. And I don't think they kind of showed that data. That was the like best mechanistic explanation I could come up with, but I don't know that that is enough to explain what we saw.
It's funny, maybe Adam. I'll sort of play devil's advocate because I don't care.
Fair enough.
You know, I think this is something I'm going to, because I have to, like, you know, push my brand whenever I can. You know, my whole shtick is medical reversal, right? It's things that we do because they've kind of got a good story, right? Like there's bioplausibility, and then there's generally, you know, some bad data, observational data, inadequate data, or maybe no data at all. And we haven't really tested it with a randomized control trial, right? And here we are, you know, with a randomized control trial showing that what we've been doing without data, but with sort of bioplausibility, you know, we're blocking platelet, you know, clotting, and we're blocking stasis clotting, you know, but finally we study it, right? And there's an overwhelming difference, right? This is frightening. This is like, I don't know, 1 in 20 people we treat this way, we actually kill. And we all know, you know, we've all filled out death certificates. We know how bad those death certificates are. The one thing that we know is that when a death certificate is filled out, the person's actually dead. And so the one really robust endpoint here is to say, this is a dangerous therapy, and we shouldn't have been doing all this time, and we should be sort of embarrassed, and we should definitely stop. And I kind of feel like this, like, as a general internist, man, this is the most important paper I've read all year.
Yeah, I am heavily influenced by your buddy John Mandrola's thoughts on this paper. I agree, it's a really important paper. And I also agree with the premise that data trumps theory every day. But just for love of the game, man, I'm so curious, why is it the case? I mean, you know, Nora, you kind of brought up, could it be that, and I unfortunately think I missed the deadline for a letter to the editor on this, because I'm really curious, you know, what the authors would say in clarification about this. Like, if we knew that, you know, these cardiovascular events were in people who did have preceding or concomitant bleeding, that might support the sort of thrombogenesis of bleeding hypothesis. You know, also, I mean, aspirin is an NSAID. I mean, this is 100 milligrams a day, so that seems unlikely to be the culprit. But I agree, data trumps theory every day.
I'm also curious how you got, so the patient population was high risk, and kind of how does this translate to patients who are not quite as high risk, and they were obviously high risk from an atherothrombotic perspective, but does it, I don't know the extent to which they were high risk from a bleeding perspective, and kind of how do we extend, are we willing to going to extend this to a broader population based on this trial?
Boy, Nora, I think that is such a good question, right? Because we get ourselves into trouble a lot. Often it seems like in the opposite direction, right? Where something works in a high-risk population and we extrapolate that to a low-risk population, right? That was our whole problem with, you know, PCA for STEMI. All of a sudden we're doing it for stable coronary disease, right? Here, I almost feel like, yeah, this population is probably most at risk of us doing harm to them, but they were probably most at risk of benefit, right? Or most likely to have benefit. And so I almost feel like a lower risk population, and here I'm doing what I just cautioned us not to do, is both extrapolate and to use theory, but I'm sucked into Rahul's camp with, like, just for the good of the game, right? Is that, a low-risk population seems like they'd have very little chance of benefit and maybe would get all the harm without any of the benefit. But it's just a great question.
Yeah, and I think some of the other studies did look at kind of more lower-risk populations in general. You know, those were a little bit different, those studies, because they were open label, conducted in different population in general, but they included patients that weren't at as high risk, and not all of them had undergone stent implantation. And actually, you know, this is to look at the higher risk. And I think regardless, looking at those studies, they had a very similar outcome, in that there's really not much benefit and a lot of harm that can be done. And I think we're seeing that just as much, you know, in the same population. So I think regardless of the different, you know, the different studies that have been done and the different, you know, what we're looking at, it does seem overall that the harm is very serious, and that there's not, if any, it's very limited benefit.
Yeah, I don't know.
why we're not carrying the authors of this study around on our shoulders and holding grades for them and things. Like, I feel like this is such a common scenario, and like, I think it's a question that's sort of asked all the time, and now we have like a good study and important data. Like, I don't know why we're not talking about it more. Like, I'm just very excited to sort of read through this and think through this and sort of hear everyone's conversation about it, because this seems critically important, but I don't remember hearing as much buzz about this as I do about, I will not cite other papers that we discussed tonight, but yeah, like, it just seems like this is pretty important, and I hope to hear more about it as we spread the good news.
Yeah, and I think it'll be really interesting to see, because the data seems very obvious that this is very, very harmful, or causes more harm than good for sure. But I'm interested to see how that actually, you know, plays out in the real world, and if people are really going to start giving aspirin on top. And I'm not sure that that's going to happen. It's, you know, changing practice is difficult, and I think that the data is very good, and this is a very strong paper. But I wonder, you know, is what's going to happen, and what will happen in the real world.
I also think, from a like time perspective, I feel like I'm getting a throwback to my days on cardiology service. But, you know, triplet therapy up front, and for how long, and then when can you de-escalate? And so this just, I think these patients were like on therapy for over several years on average. And so kind of at what point is the ideal point to de-escalate antiplatelet therapy? I'm not entirely sure at this point, but it seems like definitely sooner rather than never.
Yeah, and I think that these studies are definitely showing that DOAC monotherapy is much safer.
Who on this podcast can we blame for having discussed acetaminophen and autism and the COVID vaccine and cancer before we've discussed the aquatic trial, right?
It's almost like you're saying there should be a press conference touting the harms of dual therapy in patients with a chronic coronary syndrome above all else.
And a ticker tape parade.
All right. Well, I feel like I'm picking up the vibes here, Laura, but just to be concrete and explicit, does this change your practice, and how do we feel about this paper?
Yeah, I mean, I think the takeaway from the aquatic trial is very clear. As we mentioned, combination therapy with an oral anticoagulant and aspirin leads to more harm than good. So let's just stop it and you know, move on.
All right. Well said. And I think that was our last paper, and we ended with a bang. But I mean, I think all these were incredibly fun conversations.
I learned so much from you. Thank you so much, Dr. Sifu, for joining us.
Thank you. This was a lot of fun.
Yeah, this was amazing.
This has been another episode of The Curbsiders, bringing you a little knowledge food for your brain hole.
Yummy.
That went just as well as I was hoping it would. Still hungry for more? Join our Patreon and get all of our episodes ad-free, plus twice-monthly bonus episodes at patreon.com/curbsiders. You can find our show notes at thecurbsiders.com and sign up for our mailing list to get our weekly show notes in your inbox. This includes our Curbsiders Digest, edited by one Dr. Nora Toronto, which recaps the latest practice-changing articles, guidelines, and news in internal medicine. We are committed to high-value practice-changing knowledge, and to do that, we need your feedback, so please email us at askcurbsiders@gmail.com. It also helps a lot when you subscribe, rate, and review the show on YouTube, Spotify, or Apple Podcasts. A reminder that this and most episodes are available for CME credit for all healthcare professionals through VCU Health at curbsiders.vcuhealth.org. A special thanks to our writer and producer for this episode, which is everyone present here today, Sora Holganacha, Nora Toronto, Laura Glick. We can even throw me in there, and then also special guest Adam Sifu. We'd also like to thank our technical production team, which is done by Podpaste. Elizabeth Proto does our social media. Jen Watto runs our Patreon. Chris the Chew Man Chew moderates our Discord. And Stuart Brigham composed our theme music. Until next time, I've been Dr. Paul Nelson Williams.
I've been Dr. Rahul Bhavant Ganatra.
I've been Dr. Laura Glick.
And I've been Dr. Nora Toronto.
There's still time to get holiday ready. Right Rug Flooring makes it easy with next day installation and 24-month special financing with approved credit. Carpet, hardwood, luxury vinyl, and tile. We have everything you need to make your home shine for family and friends this season. Schedule a free in-home estimate or find a showroom near you. Visit RightRug.com. RiteRug.com. Be holiday ready with Right Rug Flooring.
Right here, right now. Coda just made riding the bus easier than ever. Now you can pay your Coda fare by tapping your smartphone, smartwatch, or card, just like you do at the coffee shop or grocery store. Love paying with smart card? Keep doing that. Have a pass? Still works perfectly. Want to tap your phone? Now you can do that too. It's just one more way to move your way with Coda. Get moving now with Tap to Pay. Learn more at coda.com/tap.